In the Philadelphia region, we tend to think of the U.S. border as being very far away, perhaps near a dusty desert in New Mexico or a forest in upstate New York. Let's talk about a time when a major border stop was right on the Delaware River waterfront. Joining me is WHYY's Laura Benchoff. Hi, Laura.
Hey, Dave.
This place hasn't operated for 100 years. Why are we bringing it up today?
So, Dave, last fall, WHYY did a story on immigration with a podcast called Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. And when we aired that story, we asked our listeners for questions about immigration. And given that that topic's in the news a lot today, many people just asked for basic context. You know, how does the immigration system work and how did it used to work? To get at that last question, I went to a small park in South Philadelphia that's kind of wedged between the Delaware River and a busy road. It doesn't look like much now, but this place, Pier 53, used to be Philadelphia's Ellis Island. While I was there, I talked to a woman named Susan McEninley, who's been helping to preserve its history.
Most of the immigration was around the time the Southern and Eastern Europeans were coming here. The peak year for immigration for this pier was 1913.
Massive steamships docked right here and dropped off hundreds of thousands of immigrants, mostly from Europe, around the turn of the 20th century.
Laura, this location, though, is not where people enter the United States now, though you spoke to a listener who has a specific question about immigration in the past.
That's right. So reporters at Reveal and I, we tackled a few listener questions about immigration. And mine came from a woman in Montgomery County named Judy Idelson.
Hi. Hey, Judy.
Found it.
I did. Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
She's a psychologist living in Bala Cynwyd, and she knows a lot about immigration because she works with immigrants applying for asylum or other kinds of status in the United States. She documents their trauma to help their cases. Idelson knows the bar is pretty high to come live in the U.S. today, and that got her wondering.
I think a lot of people with European backgrounds think they somehow are more American or they're more legitimate in their American citizenship. And I want to know, how did their families get here?
Basically, she wants to know how Europeans, white people, came to the U.S. in the 19th and 20th centuries. And did they follow the law? Buried in her question, there's also kind of a confession about her own family's past, but we'll get to that a little later. To get started, Judy and I call up Columbia University history professor May Nye.
You know, until the 1920s, we had virtually an open door from Europe, that is, into the United States.
Not all immigrants from Europe were viewed kindly then, but Nye says if you could get yourself here, government officials didn't ask too many questions.
They wanted to make sure you had a little cash in your pocket so you wouldn't become a public charge. They wanted to make sure you didn't have what was called a dangerous or loathsome disease. They wanted to make sure you weren't a prostitute.
Around the turn of the 20th century, about 20 million European immigrants streamed through this open door into the U.S. They came from Italy, from Germany, from Poland, from all over Europe. Meanwhile, May and I told me and Judy, the U.S. had started banning entire groups of people based on their race.
Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882.
Was that just Chinese? May, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, in 1882, it was Chinese. But later, Japanese were excluded and people from South Asia were excluded.
Pretty much anyone from Asia was barred from coming to the U.S. After the turn of the 20th century, just as immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe was booming, suspicion of those European immigrants was also on the rise. Labor unions worried immigrant workers would drive down wages, and there was a political movement to preserve the so-called racial purity of white America. Stanford University historian Richard White says that to justify keeping out the bad European immigrants, these groups relied on a list of nasty stereotypes.
Catholics, they can't really be Republican citizens because they'll do whatever the Pope and the priest tells them to do. Jews, the argument was Jews have no loyalty to anybody but other Jews.
That list was long.
The Italians are violent. The Italians are naturally thieves. Other groups are lazy. They're ignorant. They simply cannot be educated.
Eventually, those groups that wanted to limit immigration got their way. In the early 1920s, the U.S. passed a series of laws creating quotas that culminated in the Johnson-Reed Act of 1924, where before there was an open door, now there was a line that was first come, first served, and it was much longer for people from Southern and Eastern Europe. Historian Richard White says that when those laws went into effect, some people just started sneaking around them.
Canadian border is wide open. There's just no way to patrol that border. And it's also largely true of the Mexican border.
In the 1920s, the U.S. Immigration Service estimated about 1.5 million immigrants living in the U.S. then could have snuck into the country. Articles in the New York Times described people from Czechoslovakia and Poland paying smugglers with boats in Cuba or to get them across the U.S. border with Canada. White says that's what his own Irish grandfather did in 1924. After a trip back to Ireland a few years later, he applied to live in the U.S. legally. Sort of.
I've seen his petition for citizenship, and virtually everything on it except for his name is either a lie or wrong. I mean, he even has his own birthday wrong. He has his wife's birthday wrong. He can't list the correct number of his children.
Lying on official paperwork? That's breaking immigration law. But he and many European immigrants got away with it. A couple of decades later, listener Judy Idelson's dad did the same thing. These quota laws had kept Jews like him, people who had escaped death during the Holocaust, from coming to the U.S.
My father's name was Shaika Ivansky, and he was born in a town called Janava in Lithuania.
He was a teenager when the German army invaded.
He lost his parents, his brother, and his sister during the war.
Shaika escaped to a Jewish ghetto and took a new name, essentially pretending to be someone else. Judy says for the next 4 years, he lied whenever he had to, just to stay alive.
He was in Dachau, in a work camp, and they needed men to paint. And so he said he was a painter. He was not a painter, but he said he was a painter.
When the war ended, he made his way to a refugee camp in Germany. To get out of limbo and be with the woman he would marry, Judy's dad told a different kind of lie to the U.S. government.
My father had to pretend that he was going to rabbinical school, that he was going to study to become a rabbi in order to get a visa to come into the country.
He got a letter of admission from a school in Baltimore that he used to get a student visa. Judy's dad had no intention of becoming a rabbi. He later became a bookkeeper. And she told me it didn't hit her until after he died that what he did was really serious.
Did he become a criminal by U.S. immigration laws? He did. That was immigration fraud.
She says he worried he'd be found out. But he wasn't. He got married, had kids, and lived into old age. Judy says she's struck by how back then, the U.S. didn't devote so many resources to enforcing immigration laws, and that helped people like her dad.
Even though there were quotas, if people snuck in and they got here one way or another, they would make their life, they'd start a family, they weren't living for the rest of their lives in fear.
If Shaika were coming to the U.S. today, she says she doesn't think his story would have ended that way. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.